topics, 10 minutes each. The perfect podcast for your modern lifestyle. We're going to be talking later in the show about the date, what date it is today. If you don't know, it's because it took me too long to edit, as I'm wont to do. Also, we're going to be talking about Leah Remini. Is apparently Brian has a beef about that.
Oh, I got beef.
So if you're wondering where the beef is, it's going to be in the next segment. The first topic, though, is I just ran across an interesting news article today. It would seem that Hillary Clinton was so certain that she was going to win the White House that she had actually gone through with a purchase of a neighboring house next to her property in Chappaquiddick, where she would allow the Secret Service and her staff, her administrative staff, to stay when she was going to be in Chappaquiddick, when she was going to be taking her leave from the White House. So she dumped $1.7 million on what she now says is going to be a guest house for Chelsea.
So, well, if one of the candidates was going to make a bad real estate purchase, she was not the one I would have picked. That's a big guest house, by the way. That is quite the fancy boathouse or whatever.
Was that irony, by the way? Was that meant ironically?
Oh, it kind of works both ways with between him being an idiot and her with the Whitewater, yeah.
Oh, okay, got it.
It's kind of a double irony sandwich.
It's double irony, yeah.
It's like...
yeah, $1.7 million is... my mom has a couple guest rooms. And, you know, because we quite often, the whole family meets at her place. And it does not have a $1.7 million house for me to stay.
I guess she was trying to go the opposite direction and not charge the Secret Service rent.
Oh, no, she was. Oh, I'm sure she was. I'm sure she had calculated that into when she bought it.
I mean, they should be a write-off. I feel like the Secret Service should definitely be a very specific dependent tax write-off. I have kids,
Biden,
and I have
Biden
nine agents.
Biden was charging the Secret. That's one thing when they talk about Trump charging top rack hotel rates for when he goes to West Palm. Is people didn't realize that that Biden was renting out his pool house to the Secret Service.
Really? That is interesting.
Yeah. So it's a long-standing practice of making a little cash on the back end, setting up a sort of an Airbnb for the Secret Service, were it. So that's that was there, and of course, to make it more of a topic that's actually we can talk about, Hillary's book is out, and.
When you say it's funny, it's out, but it's like you can say it like it's out like a book, or it's like a tiger or something. You know, it's out. Hillary's book is out. Oh my God, it's escaped the publisher.
I'm sure the book was scheduled to be out a year ago, but it probably had to go through it took a little while because it had to be rewritten.
It's quite a different book.
Yeah, a much different book.
I do have it on order from the library. I did I decided to do a double feature. So I got Shattered, the book written about the campaign failure, and then I got Hers. I figure I'll do them back to back.
And see two different perspectives.
Yes. Good. I have a feeling I'll skim Hers, to be honest.
well, you know, it's actually if you are into torture. You could actually get the audio version with actually her reading it.
You know, it's a classic thing of I would be fascinated to read any really honest book written by any losing presidential candidate. I think that genuinely sounds interesting. Like if Michael Dukakis had decided, I'm going to write a book about exactly what it's like really to lose the thing, that would be fascinating to me. I don't have strong feelings about Michael Dukakis, but I think that will be interesting, you know? But just because of what we know, like, is anything less interesting than a pseudo-confessional book written by somebody who famously can never be truthful about themselves? you know what I mean? Like, what's the point?
Well, here's the interesting thing. When somebody writes their own book, you know, and they read it, you can kind of tell it because when they read it, you can hear how they've told the story to themselves in their head. It comes out that way. I just finished a Neil Gaiman audiobook.
Sure.
And you can hear Neil tell the story as he wrote it in his head.
Sure.
And it's just delightful.
He's a good reader too.
Yeah. Hillary, you can tell that it's the first time she's seen those pages.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Like any of these politicians have ever written their own, you know, like. Be it John McCain or Mitt Romney or her or Sarah Palin or, you know, like the only one I believe actually the person might have kind of written themselves was Bill's book that was based on all his like memoranda that he wrote at the White House because it was so boring that there's no way a ghostwriter wrote that.
Uh-huh.
Like the first part of it was really interesting. But like once it got into political stuff, oh my God, it was so boring. Like it was crushingly boring.
And I was like, wow,
I was like, wow, I think he did write this. This is really dope.
there's a part I actually heard an excerpt. They released a couple excerpts of her audiobook version, and she's talking about when Trump was lurking behind her at the debate, and she just said, I just wanted to turn around and say, what are you doing? Get the heck away from me. Like, really? Is that how you wanted to say it, Asperger? And what really bothers me about that audio version of the book is it's going to win this year's Grammy.
You think? I don't think so.
I will put money that her audio version of her book will be. It will at least be nominated.
No, well, okay, it might be nominated. I'm not gonna say it won't be nominated, but I don't think it'll win. I think you underestimate. Oh, I just George Bush myself. I think you underestimate how unpopular she is with young people, for the most part.
Yeah, but you're also assuming that the Grammys are the people who vote for the Grammys are young people.
Isn't that like the Academy where they're all, if you're like in the audience and in the, I don't know. I've never seen a Grammy award show in my life.
If you're in the recording industry. So it's, you know, there's executives that, you know, that are that are well beyond retirement age that are still in the Academy.
I think she's still pretty deeply unpopular. Or is newly, I think her unpopularity has reached new depths. I think a lot of people on the left blame her. I think they're right.
Huh.
I bet you, I think if you got a couple of drinks in George Clooney, he would tell you he's not a fan.
Huh.
That's my theory.
That is an interesting point. That actually is an interesting point. So we will see. When are the Grammys? Do you have any idea?
I have no idea.
they're like the lowest on the radar award, I think.
Absolutely. Like, I don't really like to watch the Oscars, and I like movies. I've seen all that stuff, you know. Like the Grammys just remind me of how old I am because I'm just like, wait, who's that? Why? Oh, I recognize the old guy singing with the young girl, but people seem excited about the young girl and not the old guy.
But to the point of the book, what has astounded me the most is that she could write, what is it, 500 pages? Let's just say 500 pages.
Sure.
500 pages of why she lost without realizing why she lost.
That does seem to be the case based on the interviews I've seen.
Yeah, she has no idea what she did when she referred to Trump supporters as a basket full of deplorables. She thought that she was, you know, that she was making a statement that people would say, "Oh, I don't want to be deplorable. I could never support Donald Trump." But in reality, what happened was, "Oh, you think that's deplorable? Oh, I'll show you deplorable." And that followed them all the way into the ballot box.
Yeah, or I saw an interview quote where they said, "Now that she's not running for office, she feels like she can really embrace her evangelical religious roots." And I was like, so what you're saying is you were pretending not to believe in God. Well, that's pretty shallow.
It's strange on two levels. Number one, that anyone would do that. And number two, that it was considered, that would be considered necessary
yeah.
in order to win an election.
Yeah, in America. Come on, man.
And I wish I had a clever ending, but I don't.
That's just like her. And in the final segment here, Rule of Three, we're going to get back to a historical topic that relates to the date. But before that, speaking of award shows, not the Grammys, but the Emmys, or rather some compartmentalized version of the Emmys was yesterday. The daytime creative arts Emmys or something, you know.
The Emmys are so broken down that I don't even know what or when the Emmys are. There's local Emmys, there's daytime Emmys, there's these are the creative Emmys.
Yeah, and like no offense, I think a friend or two of mine actually won one this year, which is I'm very happy for them. But it does kind of water down the Emmy, like the local Emmy especially. You know, if you can put Emmy winning TV producer next to your name because you won a Minneapolis Emmy for producing a historical documentary about Prince that only ran here, I feel like it kind of waters down when, you know, John Oliver gets to say Emmy-winning comedy show. It's like...
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like if you could win an Oscar for doing a short film in Minneapolis, I feel like saying Oscar-winning would mean less.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's all the short films are lumped together, and those aren't even... Those are one of those things that aren't even... part of the major Oscars, you know. It's best gaffing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that Fox TV show Laughs.
Best boy.
Yeah, this is sort of an inside comedy thing, but, you know, remember that Fox TV show Laughs was going on, that showcase, and they, like, weren't paying people, basically, and
yeah,
they were,
yeah,
but, and yeah. They asked me to do it, and I declined a couple of times, and then somebody else later was like, that was really stupid of you to turn down a TV credit, and I was like, yeah, but look at all the people who are going to be using that as a credit. There's going to be some good people with it as a credit, but it's not going to mean anything because there's going to be a lot of rando jackasses who have that as a credit. And so it's going to...
You might as well have clubs and colleges.
You might as well have place clubs and colleges. Exactly. So that's kind of what I feel like they're doing with the Emmys. But I do have a beef with the Creative Arts Emmys this year because they gave some sort of Emmy to Leah Remini. For those of you who don't know, Leah Remini was the lady who was way too attractive for Kevin James on King of Queens. She's pretty much famous for that.
Isn't that kind of the formula?
Oh, yeah. The King of Queens was like kind of the I think maybe the tip of the spear in a way of the too attractive lady for the schlub. And they have a family sitcom template.
You know, I kind of have a feeling that Ray Romano was out of his league too, though.
Well, yeah, King of Queens was a direct spinoff of that, and I don't think they ever quite the disparity that they sort of started with Ray Romano. They sort of turned up to 11 in King of Queens, and then that became the model, right? So then you get aged Jim Belushi dating Courtney Thorne Smith on his TV show, or you know, whatever.
Sure. I actually think the only time when a comedian was evenly matched with his mate, with their mate, its mate, I don't know what.
Sure.
My pronouns all messed up. I'm gonna get angry letters now from someone. Was the Roseanne Barr show?
Oh yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, well, that show, I mean, they really seemed like a real family. I mean, that was realistic show.
Exactly. It was I can't really think. You know, it's Married with Children. That was ridiculous.
Yeah.
That pairing.
Absolutely. But Leah Remini, ridiculous for another reason. The reason I have beef with Leah... Oh, yeah. The reason I have beef with... Some serious beef with Leah Remini.
Thank you for keeping me on track, by the way.
She strolls around patting herself on the back with incredible vigor over her impressive ability to stop falling for a scam. I don't find the fact that you're no longer purchasing trombones from the singing salesman to be a significant mark of your intelligence. I've never seen somebody so proud of being catastrophically stupid for about 35 years, stop being stupid, and then tell everybody else, I'm smarter than you. No. You know who's smarter than everybody? The 88% of America who never even considered reading Dianetics. That's the smart people.
Okay. In her defense, you've got to remember where she lives. And where she and the bubble that she exists inside, and
she's from like Jersey or something though.
Yeah, but how long has she been in Hollywood?
I think she was the reason her family moved to Hollywood was to like try to get famous or whatever. My point is that she acts like she was imprisoned by Scientology and all this stuff, when in reality she basically rode Scientology throughout the whole point where it was a massive help in her career. And about the time that other people like Lawrence Wright took real risks and started exposing Scientology, she jumped off the Scientology train, and now she's a real brave person for standing up against it. So not only do I think she's a loudmouth idiot, but I think she's a friggin' front runner. And I met her sister, by the way. I got in a fight with her sister on a radio show because her sister also tries to glom onto the Remini fame, and her sister is also utterly thrilled with her ability to stop falling for the most obvious religious hoax of the last 100 years. She's really.
I think you. Have we told this story on the podcast before? Because I think you do have a full story there, right?
Yeah, I think I might have gotten into that. Or maybe we talked about it off the air. I don't remember.
I think it was an off air.
But basically, her sister has converted to the most like sort of virulent form of evangelical Christianity you can imagine. And now, I'm sure she looked down her nose at these exact same people all her years of Scientology, saying what rubes they were. And now she's jumped sides, and now she's on the, like, the most sort of, like, neo-far-ranging, spiteful, hateful version of Christianity. And now acting as though, well, this is obvious the way everyone should be. And it's like, wow, you need to be led so desperately that you will really, like, you fell for the newest scam and then the oldest scam in consecutive months. Impressive
well,
ability.
It's something I think we were talking about last week or the week before, and it was a quote, and I don't know who it was from. It was one of the more famous communists. It's definitely one of the high value communist collector cards that said, you know, I will pretend it's Stalin for the sake of the argument, said that I would much rather deal with devout Christians than atheists. Because at least if you're a devout Christian, you have that talent to be devout.
Yeah, you have the template in your head, apparently.
It's much easier to transfer what you're devout to than it is to actually take someone who is skeptical and convince them.
Yeah, which is interesting because you would think it would be like you could from a kind of certain argument, you would think, well, if you start from zero as an atheist, so it's easier to like add something. You don't have to subtract anything before you add it. But I do think that is true, that it is in fact a bridge quite farther to say, you know,
yeah,
to make that happen.
Yeah, it's easier to switch a speeding train than to stop one.
Ooh, there you go. Yeah, that's exactly right.
But back to what I was saying is, I don't know Leah Remini. I don't even know if I – I think I botched it there. I don't know how long she's been inside the bubble, but she is inside the bubble, and she's solidly inside the bubble. And inside the bubble that she's in, Scientology, if you look down on Scientology, you're kind of looking at it as bigoted. And I think that there's a lot of people. I think there's a lot of people inside her bubble that share the skepticism that she does, but are not allowed to say it out loud. So that when she was up for an Emmy, they voted for her because that private vote was their way to express the displeasure of this beast that has engulfed Hollywood. And so that's why I think she got it.
I agree.
It was a vote
of approval
for what she did. And to them, to them. It's more, you know, when they're sitting down with a casting agent and a producer and director that are they know are all Scientologists, and that she has to, and they start talking about being clear, and that they want to do a film for clear people, that she can't laugh at them. But then when she gets that ballot in the mail, she's more than happy to support Leah.
Yeah, I would agree with that. She's just a real jerk. I find the smugness with which she approaches the whole thing to be pretty deeply infuriating, where it's like, oh, you're a real friggin' genius. And having met her sister and seen what a complete and utter idiot her sister is, I can only assume that the apple doesn't fart too far from the dum-dum tree.
Yeah, the both apples are the same.
All right, well, having unburdened myself of all my venom, let's go to a happier topic, 9/11.
And on the final segment of the Rule of Three, if this segment gets edited and posted online today, which I doubt, because that will only have had the other one up for 3 days, I think. I was way late last week. You will know that today is a day of somber reflection for most people, I guess. Today, of course, is September 11th, and a funny story. I was working in a club on September 11th with a mutual friend of ours, Miss Emily Glotti. Mm-hmm. She was on stage on, I think it was September 11th, maybe not, but she started talking about September 11th. And she asked some people in the audience where they were on September 11th. And one person in the audience said, kindergarten. And she, maybe she was doing it comedically, but she was a little shocked by that response. She wasn't really expecting she wasn't really asking how old were you on September 11th. She was asking, you know, what, you know, were you, you know, on the, well, for her, she was in college.
So. Right. Well, Emily's just a little bit younger than me, and so it makes sense. It feels to me like you start getting into toward your like mid 30s, and in your mind, you're still 25.
Right.
You know,
because right.
you still look basically the same as you did when you were 25. You still feel the same as you did basically when you were 25. And you start forgetting that, especially if you hang out with comedians, you know, you're like, oh, yeah, a lot of these guys are 23. That's a decade or more younger than me. And so, yeah, you go like, I was in college. Oh, they were in junior high.
The trouble is, and as someone who's been through it for a long time, the trouble is, yeah, when you're in a comedy club, you're hanging with a bunch of people that are in their 20s. You're you know, the staff is all in their 20s. A lot of the audience is all in their 20s. And you don't realize that you're not in your 20s. It's kind of like what I say. It's kind of like driving a car. As long as the interior's clean, you don't realize what it looks like on the outside.
That's absolutely true. That's a great metaphor.
And I don't think I realized how old I was until I was 40. I still believe that when I turned 40, people, that's usually when a midlife crisis starts. That's when mine was over. I had spent my midlife crisis started the day I turned 20 and lasted 20 years.
so pervasive, you hardly even noticed it.
Yeah, but what it seemed like was Emily was like, you know, where were you? Were you sleeping off a hangover from the football game?
Yeah, well, she's thinking that if you're in a
breakfast
bar.
Breakfast at the student union. Yeah.
Right? That, like, well, then you were somewhere that day. Yeah. You know, you're old enough, you know, forgetting that you could be in a bar and have been born in 1992.
Right. And so she, the person said, kindergarten. And she just went, what? And I'm sitting in the back of the room saying, yeah, I was going outside to paint my first house. And had to phone in my blood pressure prescription into the pharmacy. That's what I was doing that morning.
It's all relative, right? Because you're thinking like, wow, in college, you're so young.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it occurred to me at that point, and that we're now in a situation where there where the majority of high school kids weren't even born when September 11th happened.
Yeah,
that it's now, and it's really easy for us to forget. It is gone from current event to history.
Yeah, I think
it's somehow in the last few years. That's how you think? I just stole your words. Yeah. I think the date that it turned was the date that that Emily asked that question, and I can't remember when it was, but when I was working with her and saw her do that, but I think that right there, that was the point, because I was in kindergarten when they came over the PA that the president's been shot.
Sure.
So I still remember. I can still picture the room. I can still picture the speaker that we were all staring at when it occurred. I can still picture the look on the teacher's face. All that is still vivid in my mind at that moment. And probably for that kid that she asked, that's where were you when you found out Kennedy was shot? You know, were you having a were you at the automat ordering a sandwich? No. No, I was in kindergarten, and it was, and that's, you know, was history. That is, but by that point, you know, even though I was in kindergarten, it was history, not a current event.
Yeah, and it's given me an interesting perspective on something. I've been following this Twitter feed. You might be interested in this as well. It starts in 1939, and every day you get news about World War II from that day in 1939.
Huh.
And so, and of course, the next year it'll be 40, and then 41. And so you can basically follow the daily progress of World War II in, you know, effectively in real time. Mm-hmm. And it gives you a really – it reminds you that, like, when something becomes a historical sort of sealed in history, you know, there's sort of a sealed and amber kind of feel to it. It starts to feel almost weirdly decontextualized. You know how the ending goes. So, like, Pearl Harbor doesn't have the same shock feeling – because you know, okay, so there's Pearl Harbor, but then we get in the war, and then there's D-Day, and then we win the war, and it's all like a neat, tidy package. And I think 9/11 has become that. And so for these kids right now who see it, they're like, oh, it was this terrible thing. These planes hit these buildings. It fell. And then we went to war, but now New York's put back together. And it feels closed, like a closed-off story. But the thing that you miss from living through history is that half of the anxiety is not knowing that tomorrow the same thing won't happen again.
Right.
And that
I remember growing up because my parents lived through World War II.
Mm.
And when I was in Boy Scouts, all the scoutmasters had served in World War II.
Oh, sure.
So because of that, Boy Scouts was not the fun experience for my generation, but it probably yeah was for subsequent generations, because all the privates suddenly got the opportunity to become drill sergeants, so to speak. So it was really, and it's exactly what you're saying. Even at that point, World War II was frozen in amber for me. For me, it was just this thing that happened that they all exaggerated, and it's really weird to look back now to realize that the distance between World War II and me and Boy Scouts was only 24 years.
Yeah.
At that point, you know, it was a very long time. But looking for it from this end, it's 1993.
Yeah. Which, if there had been a war that went on for 5 years from 93 to 98, we would remember it really closely, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, the war that did happen around that time lasted about 6 months.
Yeah, right. And even now,
few casualties. I mean, it was just over real quick. We didn't know what it was like to go door to door collecting tires and grease.
Right, and such a small percentage of the American population actually serves in the military now that it's all volunteer. It doesn't have, you know, the war in Afghanistan doesn't have the same large footprint for everyone, whereas I think 9/11 was our last event that had that footprint for everybody. It didn't matter if you were in the military. It didn't matter if you – it didn't even matter if you lived in Oklahoma at the time because, you know, it was a national thing. And like I said, people that anxiety of – or the, you know, the white powder envelopes, all the things that went along with it, where, you know, the sort of year of anxiety of thinking, is this just the new normal?
Right.
Yeah, it's very different than when you, but like you said, for these kids now, it's like, no, that was a thing that happened, and now it's over, and we don't have to worry about that anymore.
And people that are worried about it are just stupid and old.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's kind of inevitable, but it is hard to it's like hard to appreciate all the former history, but until you've been through at least one historical thing yourself that gives you some bearing on like just what it's like to live through something like that. Even if again, yeah, I didn't fight in World War II or, you know, after 9/11.
But anyway, it's on that note. This wraps up another segment. All the segments are on iTunes. They're on my website, timslegel.com. Follow me on Twitter at Tim Slegel. And also...
Yep, follow me at Real Brian Miller. And they're also on my website, brianmillercomedy.com.
And if you like the show, leave us some comments. If you don't like the show, leave us some comments. Just leave us some comments. We'll pay you for comments. Give us, send us an email. We'll
and just for the record, I'm not going to pay anyone for anything because I'm poor. But I will pay you an appreciation.
I didn't say how much.
I could send them some jam for my next batch next year, you know? I'm already prepping my jam. So, yeah, see you guys next week.